The CEM Network is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart and Born to Win. I have to make one thing clear before I begin. I don't endorse any political candidate for any office. I mistrust all of them. Nonprofits and churches, you know, are not really supposed to endorse candidates. We're a nonprofit, and therefore we don't go that direction. That said, since the Bible is within my purview, when a candidate tees off on a biblical or theological topic, he opens the door for me to comment on what he has said. Now, I was surprised recently when James Dobson sounded off about a 2-year-old speech by Barack Obama. But he had only now heard the content of the speech, so he no way he could have said anything about it 2 years ago. And when I heard about it, it was the media coverage of his reaction that I was hearing. So I didn't go off half-cocked. I took some time. I went up on the internet. I read the speech first. I wanted to know what Senator Obama had said in his own words. Only then did I go and listen to the radio program by James Dobson to get from him what he said in his own words. I have this observation to make about all that. One more time, I have learned that the news media are not to be trusted at all. There were some things in the senator's speech that, taken out of context, might cause offense. But in context, I understood what he was driving at. And considering that his audience was a progressive group, it was a pretty good speech on paper. By the way, progressive is newspeak for leftist or liberal, what we have come to know as the L word. And I wonder how long it will be before people start talking about the P word for progressive. Anyway, I say it was a good speech on paper because I find the senator's style of oratory grating. I know a lot of people think he's a great speaker. I just don't share that opinion. But nevertheless, you go up and read the speech, and you really do get what he's driving at. James Dobson's response, when I listened to that, was a lot milder than the news media made it sound, and frankly, I think he was justified in taking offense at the way his and Al Sharpton's names were dropped in this conversation. But you won't get any of this from the news media. If you really want to know, you'll have to do what I did and get it from the internet. But there was one unfortunate example in Senator Obama's speech that calls for some thought and some explanation. Hearing it out of context, it's jarring. In context, it isn't much better. In his broader argument, he is making the case for the separation of church and state, a phrase, by the way, that's not in the Constitution. What is there is the statement that Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or inhibiting the free exercise thereof. And freedom of religion can only be maintained where there is no establishment religion. And, of course, I agree with Senator Obama that the Constitution does insist on the separation of religion and state. Keeping it all in context, the senator went on to say this. Even if we have only Christians in our midst, if we expelled every non-Christian from the United States of America, whose Christianity would we teach in the schools? Would we go with James Dobson's or Al Sharpton's? Which passages of Scripture would guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay, and that eating shellfish is abomination? How about Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Or should we just stick with the Sermon on the Mount, a passage that is so radical that it's doubtful that our own Defense Department would survive its application? So before we get carried away, let's read our Bibles. Folks haven't been reading their Bibles. To that last, I agree. I think that he would have skated on his first point. That is, we are trying to keep our religion separate from the state. He would have skated on it if he had resisted naming names. But orator that he is, he or his speechwriter couldn't resist concrete examples. So he had to go on and give us concrete examples. Now, the first three examples, slavery, eating shellfish, stoning your child if he strays from the faith, betray a serious lack of understanding of biblical law. I discuss these issues at length in my book, Law and Covenant, and I'll come back to them if time permits. But for now, I want to go to the reference to the Sermon on the Mount. He said this, "Or should we just stick to the Sermon on the Mount, a passage that is so radical that it's doubtful that our own Defense Department would survive its application?" It was at this point his speech was interrupted by sustained applause, which surprised me until I figured out who his audience was. So what's he talking about here? What's radical about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, nothing at all, if you understand that it was a message of instruction, not for governments, not for departments of governments, but for individuals in private life. Now, I don't fault Senator Obama for not knowing this, because an awful lot of Christian folks don't know it. But it's not a good idea to talk about things you don't fully understand. I have an idea that he was referring perhaps to Matthew 5:5 in the Sermon on the Mount, which says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Now, there is not a thing meek about an armored column charging into Baghdad, nor is there anything meek about troops kicking in doorways looking for enemy terrorists. Okay? That's not meek. Maybe he had in mind Matthew 5:7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." Well, sometimes the military show mercy, sometimes they can't. Matthew 5:9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." Now, when you keep in mind that these are directed at men and women in private life, you will be on the way to understanding where the senator put his foot wrong. But I have an idea. The dominant passage would have been this one, Matthew 5, verse 38. "You have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that you resist not evil, but whoever shall smite you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also." And so, turning the other cheek has entered our language as a symbol of nonviolence. And this is one of the things I've learned to really respect about Dr. Martin Luther King, that his whole approach to solving the problems of race in our society was nonviolent. Now, how is it possible to live in society and not resist evil? If you take the literalist approach to you, if a mugger comes up to you on the street and threatens you, your wife, your kids, well, you're not to oppose him. If a thief breaks into your home, you must not defend yourself or your wife or your children. If you take that approach, thankfully, most Christians have found a way to defend their home in spite of the radical interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount. By the way, did you notice I did not say the sermon was radical, but the interpretation of the sermon might be? Now, what was Jesus advocating, and how are we supposed to react to evil? The answer is that a government that protects us and avenges the helpless is what makes it possible for us to live peaceably in society. If we're going to understand what Jesus is calling us to do, we first have to understand the roles, the respective roles of law and government, as opposed to the laws of people in private life. A good place to start with these fundamentals is with the instructions of Paul to a handful of small churches living right in the belly of the beast. Stay with me through this short break, and when I come back, I'll tell you what he said.
Law and covenant are two of the most basic ideas in Christian thought, yet both are poorly understood by many Christians. Ronald Dart's book, Law and Covenant, is available today at your local bookstore. For more information, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791, or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. That's 1-888-242-5344.
Unless you live in some dangerous places, probably you go through your day and never even give this a second thought. But the reason why you don't have to have a six-gun strapped to your hip, the reason why you don't necessarily even need to have a gun in your house, is because, by and large, the police, the government, the security of our country is such that we are able to go through our lives day after day after day after day with no need to defend ourselves because of the structure of our government and our law enforcement. Well, when it comes to the Bible, and this is something important for us to understand, is there's a reason why you can live in the world at large this way. Paul, writing to the Romans, beginning in chapter 12, verse 17, said this: "Do not repay anyone evil for evil." Just don't do it. "Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone." Now, what he means by this is do what is right within the sight of everyone, not that everybody's going to think what you're doing is right. That's not required. That's not possible. Then he says this: "As far as it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone." Now, obviously, it isn't always possible. Sometimes you can't. "Do not take revenge," Paul went on to say, "but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." Now, this is the way you and I are supposed to live our lives. But there is something of overriding importance in this short passage that you could miss. For some reason, many people seem to believe that vengeance is a bad thing. It's not. Vengeance is the central value of justice. And notice God says, "Don't you take revenge. Leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge. I will repay,' saith the Lord." So, payment has got to be made for bad things that people do. But vengeance, you say, is the work of God, not man. Absolutely right. But then we have established that vengeance is a good, not a wrong. Then we ask, what is God's instrument for exacting vengeance? Paul goes on, chapter 13, verse 1. "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist," King James, "the powers that be, have been established by God." Now, mind you, the governing authority where these little churches sat was Rome. And Paul says, you've got to be under this kind of authority which God has established. They are established by God. But basically what he means by this is the institution of the state is a part of God's plan for governing man. Okay. Consequently, Paul goes on to say, "He who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves." God has instituted a system, first of all with Israel, and later in other ways has allowed it to be, so that you and I do not have to execute judgment on our own behalf. We do not have to avenge crimes against ourselves. It is up to the government to do that, and the government is the agent of God in actually carrying it out. What happens if you don't do this? Well, you've heard of the old feud of the Hatfields and McCoys, haven't you? The blood feud is the natural result. Vigilantism is the natural result, where people go out and they execute their own judgment. He goes on to say, "Rulers don't hold any terror for those who are right, but for those who do wrong. You want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he'll commend you." Now, Paul is generalizing here. Obviously, there have been evil governments that were a terror to people who were doing right. But that's not what we're talking about here. He goes on to say about governmental authority, "He is God's servant to you for good. If you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an avenger to bring punishment on the wrongdoer." Now, I don't know if you understand what you're reading here, but what he is talking about is violent justice, but through the sword. In other words, the death penalty can be involved. Who is God's servant? Who is an avenger? The government, the powers, the authorities that exist. That's what he's talking about. "Therefore, it is necessary," Paul said, "to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience." Now, this is crucial to understand. Government is the agent of God to protect the weak and to avenge the victims of wrongdoing. So let's do a little theology here. Is the Sermon on the Mount really so radical that if applied, it would scrap the Defense Department? And, of course, it would also, if that reasoning would, it would scrap the police departments as well. The very idea is nonsense. The Sermon on the Mount is not an instruction for governments, but for the man of God in his private life. Turn the other cheek does not speak to the police department or the defense department. That's nonsensical. Now, this is one of the reasons why I become uncomfortable when a candidate for office starts talking about the Bible. I'm concerned that he may be confusing his responsibility as a private Christian with his responsibility as a civil leader. Think about that for a moment. You want the person you're going to be electing to office to be a good person. But the problem is, he may not be a nice person. Because nice people don't do what he may be called upon to do as a head of government. It's as simple as that. It's not nice to lock people up in prison, but sometimes it's got to be done. It's not nice to execute a murderer. Sometimes it has to be done. It's not nice to invade another country. Sometimes it has to be done to bring an end to people like Adolf Hitler. We did it, and we were right. Now, if the government does not do its duty to protect, if out of some vague notion that the government's supposed to turn the other cheek or be nice to people, the natural result is going to be vigilantism and social chaos. Now, here's our question. Just how much has changed since Old Testament times? Less than you might think. One thing that has not changed is God himself. He makes that very clear. The difference lies in the area we are talking about, governmental responsibility. Some aspects of Old Testament law are governmental. For example, the laws regulating slavery. These were laws that pertained to a particular government. Senator Obama is understandably bothered by the laws in Exodus that permit slavery. I certainly was. I remember the first time that I seriously ran across them. I'd read the chapter in the book of Exodus that deals with the Ten Commandments, and then I went right on into the section following, which talked about all kinds of things you could do with slaves. I didn't like what I read, and I had to think my way through it. Senator Obama asked, should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay? Well, first of all, it isn't really Leviticus, it's Exodus, but in any case, neither book suggests that slavery is okay. What the law is doing is regulating a necessary practice. Now, I can see already many people who have a visceral reaction against any idea of slavery are going to say, what do you mean a necessary practice? How could that be? Well, of course it was a necessary practice. We still practice slavery to this day for much the same reason. That may come as a surprise to you, but we do. We call it prison. When we had a draft, we called it military service. But bear in mind, Israel was a society without prisons. You know, that really kind of in a way sounds wonderful, doesn't it? There was not a prison anywhere in Israel. Well, okay, then what did you do with the thief when you caught him? First of all, he had to make full restitution with punitive damages for anything that he had done like this. That was a part of the law. If he had nothing with which to make restitution, which most thieves didn't, he was put on the auction block and sold off to the highest bidder. His maximum sentence was 6 years. And what happened is, when he was sold off on the auction block, the money from the sale went to the person that he had wronged. So some restitution was made. This is the whole idea. Even vengeance is a matter of putting things right, restoring the balance of things. Now, what the Bible did was to regulate what the government could do with miscreants. Unlike Rome, where the slave was the property of the owner with no rights, in Israel, there were rights granted to slaves. When you read through Exodus 21 and following where it talks about slavery, it's jarring to a person in the 20th century, but when you crank into your thinking that slavery was a general custom in the world at that time and there were no prisons at all, then you begin to suddenly realize what it's doing is preventing abuse of slaves in a way that they might be in other societies and civilizations. Slaves in Israel were not mere property. They were human beings with rights. Now, I suppose it's fair to say that Senator Obama's theology was off base. But the point of the speech was not the theology. His point was the separation of religion and state. And after all, he's running for president, not national theologian. And he would have been fine if he stayed within his field of expertise. Unfortunately, he had to give those specific examples. I'll talk about the other items he mentioned, but first, grab a pencil and a pad. I want to give you an address and a phone number, and I'll be right back with more.
For a free CD of this radio program that you can share with friends and others, write or call this week only and request the program titled The Politics of Religion. Write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. That's 1-888-242-5344.
He also mentioned the laws from Leviticus to talk about eating shellfish, pork, and things like that. Actually, eating shellfish is not a governmental matter, wasn't even then, except as the health department becomes involved. Probably very few Bible readers realize this, but in Israel, the priests were the health department. There is a need for a department of public health because, you know, people, restaurants, and what have you will not always do the right thing. So, in Israel, the priests had the responsibility for inspecting houses that had mold in them, for looking at a skin problem on a person with a contagious disease, and so on. We do much the same thing. We just do it with elected officials instead of hereditary Levites. The dietary laws were for individuals, not for the state to concern itself with. Now, one more issue needs to be addressed. The senator went on to ask, how about Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Now, that statement is misleading. Here's what the law actually says, Deuteronomy 21, verse 18. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that, when they have chastened him, will not listen to them. In other words, they've done everything they possibly can to control this boy. Then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him to the elders of the city, to the gate of his place. Now, two important things, at least, to mention here. One, this boy was entirely out of control. I have very little doubt that the very existence of this law would have curbed not a few indulgent parents from their being so indulgent. But more important than that, this could not be done without due process. It wasn't just because their kid had left the faith. The kid was in pretty bad conduct before you ever got down this, and they couldn't go out and stone him themselves. They had to take him to court. And having taken him, they say to the elders of his city, "This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. And you're going to put away evil from among you, and Israel shall hear and fear." Well, yeah, I expect they would. Frankly, I doubt if it ever had to be done. If so, it probably wasn't done but once. You got to remember, this is a society with no prisons. I think I like that idea better than ours. A society with no prisons, so you've got to do something about uncontrollable people. And it's hard to imagine how evil a son would have to be for parents to bring him to court with the death penalty hanging in the balance. But all of this is entirely irrelevant. This could only be done by a nation whose constitution permitted it. We call it a constitution. They called it a covenant. And we don't live under the Israelite covenant. We live under the United States Constitution. And I think that's probably a good thing in God's eyes, because that Constitution establishes freedom, a fundamental value in God's purpose for man. Occasionally, freedom has to be curtailed for people who aren't willing to live responsibly. Now, we may think our Constitution is better or worse than the Israelite covenant, but it doesn't matter. Where we live, we are under our Constitution, and God expects us to abide by it. So said Paul. Reflecting further on Senator Obama's speech, there is something that wasn't mentioned in any media report I saw. This was not a religious speech about politics. It was a political speech about religion. That's an important distinction. I'll say it again. It was not a religious speech about politics. It was a political speech about religion. And to understand any speech, you need to understand the audience. The group that the senator was addressing was a progressive organization. I have a feeling he had not tumbled to the fact that you really don't have private speeches with private organizations when you're in political office. By now, that should be dawning on him. Whatever you say is going to become public. Looking at the website of the organization that sponsored that conference, I noticed the expression social justice repeated all often. The idea of social justice means different things to different people. It's used by progressives in this country, and it owes its origin to Marxism for the non-religious person, to liberation theology for the religious person. The idea from one source is it's a society in which justice is achieved in every aspect of society rather than merely by the administration of law. It is generally thought of as a world which affords individuals and groups fair treatment and an impartial share of the benefits of society. This was the utopian idea of Marxism, from each according to his ability, according to each according to his need. Now, you don't have to think about this very long before you begin to realize that what this means is we're going to have to take stuff from one person and give it to somebody else in order to equalize all this stuff, and that involves a serious loss of freedom for everyone concerned. There is one thing that surfaces from this left-right comparison. The left-wing approach involves a fear that freedom cannot produce a just society. But that all depends on what you mean by that. Is it just to take property from one man and give it to another? We'll have to think about that. Until next time.
You have heard Ronald L. Dart. If you would like more information, or if you have any questions, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. In the U.S. and Canada, call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. And visit our website at borntowin.net.